Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Dave Zirin, has managed to create a nice niche for himself, writing about the intersection of sports and politics. Journalist and author Ron Jacob says Dave is the man who politicized the sports pages. He takes on those people and institutions that have crippled sports in the name of profit and power, while championing those athletes and others who have used their name and position to make sports a force for change. When he talks to fellow sports writers, some quietly tell him to keep up the good work, keep exposing issues that don't get the attention they deserve on the sports page, things like class, race, gender, stadium subsidies, and massive, massive profits. But other sports writers quietly tell him to just go away. Dave Zirin says sports has become such a big business that the line between journalism and being a broadcast partner for all intents and purposes has been obliterated. Dave Zirin is sports editor at The Nation magazine. He hosts Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM, and he's the author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. And Dave joins me here in studio. Hi, Dave. Great to see you again.
It's great to be here, and I'm particularly happy to be here because it is pledge time at KLW. And I just want to say why that's the case. This isn't me pumping people to call in for money, but I'm excited about it because I never would have gotten my start without independent media wanting to hear an independent analysis of sports. There was no way the mainstream sports media was going to have me on to give opinions about things that criticize their broadcast partners, which are the big leagues. And so anything that can be done to support independent media, like I'm living proof that it's about supporting independent voices, and it does make a difference.
Well, thank you so much. And to let our listeners in Santa Cruz and the Monterey area know, we're on pledge. And so we hope that you also support KUSP when they're on pledge. And thank you so much. Well, and to that point, Dave, how have you been able to create this nice niche for yourself? When did you first get involved in sports writing?
Well, I've been into wanting to be a sports writer, having the aspiration of being a sports writer as when I was 12 years old and I was at Game 6 of the 1986 World Series, the famous game where the ball went through Bill Buckner's legs. And I remember just being absolutely blown away. I was in the first row behind the Mets dugout, and I still have my ticket stub from being there. And just this will give you an idea about how much the sports business has changed. The price on that ticket stub, and it's in my house right now, it says $25. First row behind the Mets dugout, a $25 ticket for Game 6 of the World Series.
And how much is it today?
You would have to probably go through StubHub. You would probably have to be connected to a corporation that would own those tickets. And to be able to get in on buying one of those corporate seats for a Game 6 in New York City, I would say it would cost four figures.
Four figures?
Yeah.
For a baseball game behind home plate?
Behind the Mets dugout, yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize
and
that.
And it was nuts. And you know what you lose when you get that is you lose that kind of passion. I mean, I remember we were in the front row. It looked like the Mets were going to lose. They were down 5-3 in the 10th inning. It was the deciding game for the Red Sox to win. And people were crying. I'll never forget Keith Hernandez made the second out in that game before their improbable two-out rally. And as Keith went into the dugout, a guy next to me, literally breaking down in tears, said, "It was a great season, Keith." And Keith Hernandez looked up at him, and there was this fierce fire in Keith Hernandez's eyes, and he looked really sad too. And now I think Keith Hernandez would look up and see somebody, I don't know, eating, drinking a Bellini or something. It's a very different scene now at the ballpark.
Or a $10 beer.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, my God. For World Series, they'd probably jack it up a little bit. A $15 flat beer.
Well, and I understand you were actually writing a column at a small newspaper that really wasn't political. And then you had an interesting interaction with one of your not-so-friendly bosses.
Yeah, it was an African-American-owned newspaper. And the reason why I took the job there was because they said they would let me write my own sports column, which was all I ever really wanted to do. And I kept it very much strict sports, even though I had all of these political leanings and political analyses about sports. I'd read a book that influenced me greatly called Redemption Song, Muhammad Ali and the Spirit of the 60s by Mike Marcosi, which is an amazing political breakdown, autopsy of the career of Muhammad Ali. And My boss, I overheard him on the phone speaking at great length to a friend about like going through the ups and downs of something he'd heard on the radio that day. And at the end of it, he said, "Gotta love that Amy Goodman." And I heard that. And Amy Goodman, of course, the longtime host of Democracy Now. And I'm a huge Amy Goodman fan. And when he said that, I was like, whoa, I have an in with my boss here. So I got to tell him, I said, "Sir, I like Amy Goodman, too. And I'd love to, you know, explore some of that with my sports writing." And he was incredibly encouraging for me to do so. And he was excited about it, particularly because it was an African-American paper in a majority African-American county. And the idea in particular of exploring issues of race and racism in sports in a town where people root for a team called the Redskins was something that, for my boss, instead of something to shy away from, was something he actually thought would amplify the newspaper, which to me also speaks to one of the things that we're losing with the conglomeration of big media in this country. It's not talked about nearly enough. There's a lot of talk about the death of the local newspaper, but not a lot of people talk about the death of the black press. And if you know about the history of what the black press brought to the table in this country, reporting on lynchings when nobody would speak about lynchings, reporting on Jim Crow, and in the sports world, reporting on issues of race and racism in sports, especially in the first 50 years of the 20th century, and indispensable sports writing gave us legends like Sam Lacy and all these folks who really, I think, I mean, you want a new generation of Sam Lacy's. You want a new generation of Wendell Barry's, who's featured in the Jackie Robinson movie 42. And the idea that that space isn't going to be there is an American tragedy.
Well, do you see young people coming up the ranks to write about sports, and what opportunities are there for them?
Well, there's good news and bad news in that department. I mean, the good news is that the internet has opened up these incredible worlds for people to actually develop writing and develop their voices. And I see a young generation of sports writers who want to write about sports from a feminist perspective, who want to write about sports from an LGBT perspective, write about sports from every possible nationality perspective. And that's incredibly encouraging. And they're hitting the blogs. A lot of them aren't being paid to do it, but they have a razor sharp analysis, and they're expanding the definition of what we mean by sports writing. That's the plus. The minus, of course, is that you still have to make a living.
Right.
And that's where it gets really tough, because the conglomeration of media, the incredible contraction of neighborhood newspapers, one of the things that means is that some of my favorite writers, some of the best sports reporters that I know, now work for things like NBA.com, NFL.com, MLB.com. And so they're like directly working for the sports leagues themselves. And the crazy thing is that it's eerie, because they still, if you go to the websites, they still produce great sports writing. It's not like someone taught them how not to write or do an interview. But there's that weird kind of sensation when you read it of you're wondering, is this compromised in any way?
And are they able to write about things like stadium subsidies, or the raise that the coach just got, or the workers at AT&T Park, for example, also known as Candlestick, who just voted to go on strike? Are they, quote, allowed to write about those issues?
That's the good question. And the other issue, and Bill Moyers talks about this a lot with regards to big media, is it self-censorship that we're seeing as well? Like, that's what Bill Moyers writes about very persuasively, is that it's not so much that you have someone in a dark room like Montgomery Burns calling you up and saying, "Kill the story." But it's more that it's just sort of assumed that if you're in the building and you're writing these stories, that you'll know where the barometers are. And that sometimes is more devastating and more constricting than if you actually tried to push those boundaries.
Well, because, and this isn't new, but there are so many issues to write about that are connected to sports. I mean, even if you're not a hardcore sports fan, this stuff is so interesting. I mean, labor, LGBT issues, gender, rape. I mean, there's sexual assault. There's just so much.
And the thing is that it's a lens by which you can reach people who otherwise would not be interested in politics. Like, I'm sure there are people in the Bay Area who have had it up to here with discussions about labor, gentrification, the affordability of the city. You know, they'll roll their eyes and turn their heads when you try to have that discussion. But talk to them about AT&T Park. Talk to them about the workers who make just $11,000 per season and only get health care during the season. Talk to them about the people who drive for 2 hours to work at the games. Like, talk because they can't afford to live in the city. Talk about those issues. Talk about the people who are actually serving them those $10 beers, and maybe you get a different kind of discussion. Maybe you get to open people's minds a little bit.
Well, so what happened when you wrote that column and brought in politics? What sort of response did you get from readers?
Well, it's interesting because the response was massive when my brother-in-law, who's a kind of a computer head, he put him online. And he put a little tagline at the end. He wrote this little program for it where people could click on a link at the end and would automatically be put on a listserv to receive the column every week. And I thought, like, okay, cool. That'll be a good way to make sure, like, my friends get it every week without me having to remind them to read it or whatever. Like, I didn't think it would be much of anything. But it quickly got, like, several thousand people in very short order. And what that said to me was that there are a lot of people out there who love sports but hate what sports have become. Mm. And that there's this huge group of, you could call them the alienated sports fan, that exists. And so when I started, that's who I felt like I was writing for in a big way. Not so much people like yourself, Rose. Not so much people who say, I'm not interested in sports, but I'm a political junkie, so I like what you're writing.
I used to be interested in sports.
Yes, I know.
When the games were shorter.
Your dad disavowed you of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and we'll talk about that, why the games are now longer.
Sure.
I didn't even realize that until Dave and I did an event last night, and it was really interesting. But now, so you write for The Nation,
yeah,
a sports column. Do you hear from readers who maybe aren't that political and maybe didn't know about The Nation, but who follow your sports writing?
Oh, definitely.
And what do you hear from them?
Definitely. I mean, what's interesting, and this is just something about the web, is the overwhelming majority of people who go to columns in The Nation online go there through direct links, not through the homepage, which is very busy and has a million different articles. So it's a lot of people who would go to The Nation site who would not otherwise go there. And that's what sports is. It's a bridge. And, you know, what people generally say, I mean, it depends on the issue always. I mean, I get a lot of love, get a lot of hate, which is understandable because we're conditioned in a lot of ways to not break what Howard Cosell called rule number one of the jockocracy, you know, the idea that sports and politics shouldn't mix. But when it's an issue that people care about, they respond very strongly. And when it's an issue that people don't want you to explore, they certainly let you know that too. Because it's like, hey, you're getting in the way of me enjoying the games. And I just say, like, no, you know, the person who says, hey, there's a fire, isn't the person responsible for the fire. And what's getting in the way of me enjoying, for example, the local Washington football team is the fact that they have a racist name called the Redskins. You know, that's not me imposing that on the game. That's objective. And pointing it out is just about opening our eyes and seeing something that's demonstrably disgusting.
And I mentioned in the introduction that fellow sports writers often contact you, and some quietly tell you, keep it up, this is great, and others say, can you just go away?
Yeah, both those things happen. And obviously I like the former a lot more than the latter. And I'd like to also see, and I think this is an important role for all independent media, is see ourselves as also trying to prod and push people who have these mainstream media positions to try to actually explore these issues as well. I mean, the point is not to have a niche and be like the sports politics guy. The point is to change the culture and have it be something that's normalized in sports writing and sports media, the idea that we explore these issues.
We're speaking with Dave Zirin. He is sports editor at The Nation magazine. He hosts Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM, and he's author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. And what are your thoughts about some of the issues that Dave writes about? If you're a sports fan or if you read the sports pages, have you found that some of these articles are bringing in things like labor and gender and LGBT issues? We'd love to hear from you. And if you have any questions about the intersection of sports and politics, Dave is the man to ask. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. I mean, here in Northern California, we have massive stadium, some of the most profitable teams. So if you also have questions about how the money trickles down or not, because we're talking about, I mean, the Giants owner, what's his name again?
Charles Johnson.
He's worth $6 billion, and we're going to talk about the Giants. So if you have any questions about the intersection of sports, politics, and money, we'd love to hear from you. And also, what do you notice in the media when it comes to how these issues are covered? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So what about the massive profits, Dave? Because, I mean, when you look at how much these franchises bring in, it's just huge. The Giants, for example, since the World Series, in the last 2 years, their profits have spiked. The ticket prices have gone up. The beer prices have gone up. And yet the concession workers' wages have been flat for 3 years. They haven't had a raise.
Yeah. And that speaks to who runs sports franchises at this point. Because the people who run them, I mean, I keep thinking about that Mitt Romney line where he talks about where he was caught on camera saying that the point is for mutual funds, for hedge funds to harvest the profits out of companies. And Charles Johnson, the owner of the team, he comes from that world. And the Giants get 55% of every dollar that's spent at the stadium, even though it's subcontracted through a South Carolina company called Centerplate. And this idea of harvesting the profits, this idea of saying that we need – that part of our mission is to pay the workers as little as possible as we can get away with is a mentality that exists in far too many major league owner suites. It doesn't exist in their relationship to the players, but it exists in relationship to everybody who works at the stadium, even though they're making not even peanuts, let alone Cracker Jacks.
Well, and why is it that they – subcontract this work? So basically Centerplate provides the food and the drinks and and all the concessions. Why do they have to do that? Or do they have to?
Yeah, I mean, most of them, they do the same way, like, say, a typical college or university now subcontracts through places like Aramark, and they sell the – or Sodexo, and they sell the food through that. It's a way to manage the product. The issue in this case, though, is that the San Francisco Giants profit mightily from doing it. And so it's like, where are the raises going? Well, they're going in the pockets of Charles Johnson. I mean, the idea, I mean, that's a pretty outrageous number that they get 55% in their subcontracting deal through this South Carolinian company. And that's where I think the restitution needs to come from. And one of the most disturbing things in talking to the workers there at AT&T Park, who voted 97% to go on strike, is the fact that the San Francisco Giants, and they just keep passing the buck and saying, well, it's not us. Talk to Centerplate. And it's like, no, the buck actually stops with you. Where is your corporate accountability in this situation? It's just not there. I mean, he's as unaccountable as Wall Street was during the 2008 crash.
And so we're talking 800 workers. They earn $11,000 per season. They start at 10:45 an hour for the first 50 games and make between $13.52 and $19.44 an hour after that. Four concession workers, all women. Some who have worked there for 35 years were at the event last night. And like you said earlier, they said that some people have to drive 2 hours to get here because they can't afford housing in the area.
Now, the housing prices are really high, and I hope people take this issue seriously. This is a labor town, and you know, if there's this growing movement in the country of service workers who are fighting for union recognition, if they can break them here in San Francisco, it sends a signal to corporate America throughout the country.
Well, the workers said that other stadiums are watching because Charles Johnson and other owners were on a conference call recently, and other owners said, how are you making so much money? We need to learn from you.
Exactly.
So what do you think about the coverage? Because it was a 97% vote, this is getting widely covered.
Yeah. It's starting to, anyway. I can't speak for the local press here and how it's being talked about, but it's starting to be heard that this is going to happen. And it, as a story, it's something that I mean, that's the problem, is that most sports pages won't touch this because they'll see it as a labor story. The problem is that with cuts in newspapers, one of the first things to go is what used to be called the labor beat, this idea of people who are specifically charged to look at happenings with unions and the labor movement. And so without that, it's you wonder how people who aren't seeking this story out, who aren't connected to labor issues around social media, are they going to hear about this? And so I think that that's certainly going to be one of my goals in the days ahead, is like, how do you get this posted on message boards that deal with baseball? So baseball fans are forced to confront that this is happening.
Dave Zirin is sports editor at The Nation and author of Game Over. And let's hear from Jim in Berkeley. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ruth. Dave, I'm really glad that you've injected or at least highlighted the politics within sports, because sports is becoming very corrupt. One of the issues that I want to hear you talk about is the lawsuit with the NCAA over payment of college athletes.
No, absolutely. There's a huge case that could change the NCAA forever.
Can you give us a little background?
Yeah. No, all of this started when a former most outstanding player of the 1995 NCAA tournament, a player by the name of Ed O'Bannon for UCLA, he comes home from work. He's working at a car lot in Nevada. Comes home and sees a couple of his young relatives playing a video game. And one of the people in the video game is him. And he's like, what? You know, he's like, as his UCLA self. And he was never asked for permission about this. He's certainly not being paid for this. And the NCAA owns the rights to his personhood. And since then, he's gotten other people involved in this lawsuit, like Bill Russell and Oscar Robertson. And they're suing not just the NCAA, not just around this particular ENA Sports video game, but around the mere idea that players are not entitled to their own labor in commercial ventures. Now, this is different from the bigger issue about should players be paid for actually playing these revenue-producing sports, but it speaks to things like, all right, if you're Mike Krzyzewski and the coach at Duke and you get $2 million a year because your players wear Nike when they run up and down the court while you're standing there in wingtips, are your players entitled to a piece of that? Up until now, the answer to that question has been no. And college sports is just so particularly disgusting because the money in it has gotten so huge, and therefore the demands on players has gotten so intense. So the idea, the fiction that they're in any way, shape, or form student athletes who have in any way a chance to actually take advantage of the college experience and get an education is an absolute joke.
How is that changing for college athletes?
Well, what's changing more than anything is consciousness of these athletes in terms of seeing what's going on and how much money is involved. I'll give you just one example of how this has changed. 30 years ago, the coach at Ohio State, legendary coach Woody Hayes, he made $42,000 a year.
30 years ago.
30 years okay. ago. Made 42 grand a year. Today's coach at Ohio State, Urban Meyer, has a base salary of $4 million a year. So think about that. Over 30 years, 40,000 to 4 million. And think about that also in the context of a state school like Ohio State, like most state schools, budget crunches, the whole incredible privation that's happening to public education in this country, but more and more money going to King football. And it's this sort of thing where players see this and it becomes an avenue for corruption in and of itself. And that's why the scandal at Penn State involving the horrible sexual assaults by former assistant coach Jerry Sandusky and the cover-up by the school, I know that's why it chilled so many people to the bone, is this idea of like, okay, where is the line then by which a school, through its sort of banality of evil, would go to protect football and everything it produces at the school in terms of revenue, in terms of alumni attention, in terms of branding the school as a winner or a loser or what have you? And how far would a school go to protect its imperatives? At Penn State, you saw that the bottom of the well was really dark.
Yeah, and actually that angle did start getting some attention in the middle to the end. And after the break, I'd love to ask you if you think that has changed the culture at all. We're speaking with Dave Zirin, sports editor at The Nation. He hosts Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM, and he's the author of Game Over. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on media coverage of these issues and the connection between sports and politics? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, general manager of KALW, and in this two-minute break, Joe Burke and I are going to ask you to support local powered radio, KALW, and your call. The number to do that at, 800-525-9917, or you can go online to kalw.org.
Online, kalw.org, or 800-525-9917. And we do have a wonderful thank you gift if you can pledge at the $120 level today. It's Dave's newest book, Game Over. Again, 800-525-9917 or online, kalw.org.
And it's a book that is full of stories that talk about this corrupting relationship between journalists, politicians, and the sports figures that the journalists are supposed to be covering. And those kind of relationships that your call and the Media Roundtable talk about every week. And here at KALW, I mean, I think it is important to say who pays, right? And so somebody's working for NBA.com or MLBSports.com, you know who's paying there. Well, here at KALW, it is listeners who make it happen. Be the next person to keep a really positive relationship between the paymasters and us. That's what's happened. It's you and us together. We make this happen. 800-525-9917.
This is our Shorter is Better spring campaign, and we will be back to Rose Aguilar and her guests on this morning's Your Call in just a brief moment. Matt Martin and I, the general manager, has taken this time to ask for your support, your contribution to local public radio. And then coming up in the next hour, Rose will be chatting. I had it here a moment ago.
Robert McChesney. Media theorist, author of Digital Disconnect. We're going to have a great bonus hour of the Media Roundtable. And Joe, in this hour, we do have a challenge.
Oh, we do.
And that's 25 listeners getting involved. $1,000 extra dollars for KALW if we make it there. But we're doing Shorter is Better. We're going back to Dave Zirin in 10 seconds. 800-525-9917. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we're going to have a conversation about salt, sugar, and fat, how the food giants hooked us, by Michael Moss. And then on Tuesday, we will talk about the tragedy in Bangladesh, and we'll talk more broadly about the garment industry. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're speaking with Dave Zirin, sports editor at The Nation. He hosts Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM, and he's author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. He says that sports has become such a big business that the line between journalism and being a broadcast partner for all intents and purposes has been obliterated. So if you have any questions for Dave about the intersection of sports and politics, we'd love to hear from you. If you read the sports page, what do you think? How do you think sports journalism has changed over the past couple of decades? Dave actually has some interesting insights on how it's actually, there used to be a lot of issues in the sports page, and especially when you're talking about women in sports, but that has drastically declined in the last 20 years. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And let's hear from Patrick in Santa Cruz. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, good morning. I want to talk about referees cheating, like especially in the Super Bowl. And the last Super Bowl is a prime example of and you hear the announcer goes, "Oh, we're not going to let the game be decided on a foul." It's like, what? We're not going to play by the rules? It's like Bush v. Gore. Let's suspend rationality in the rules so the team that we want to win is going to win.
I'm going to guess you're a 49ers fan.
No, not at all. I'm a Broncos
okay.
fan.
Oh, okay.
But I'm an alienated sports fan, as you called us. Big time.
Why are you alienated?
Sports used to be in the 60s and 70s, it's me against you, and whoever the best man is going to win.
Or woman, but yes, you're absolutely right.
And it's no longer that.
No, I hear that from people a lot. Thank you so much for the call. I do hear that from people a lot, is that this idea that sports is this one sort of space where in U.S. society you actually have a level playing field. A lot of people feel disavowed of that. You could certainly make a strong case that that's never really been true. But if you're looking at the trajectory of the 20th century with, for example, the period of segregation and the color line that really lasted in sports after World War II, you're talking about in the 60s and 70s, probably the time when it was the closest to that ideal, where before the influx, for example, of performance-enhancing drugs, before the influx of the incredible amount of money that goes into being a youth athlete and being in the pipeline to go from being a youth athlete to being a professional, which now I think really does privilege middle-class families who are also, by the way, making tremendous financial sacrifices so their kid can be a part of that pipeline, or poor families who then devote their entire lives to their kid being a part of this, which obviously privileges poor families where you might have one of the parents have the time and space to be able to do that. I mean, in the 60s and 70s, there was more of, frankly, an expanded physical education system in this country, which doesn't exist anymore. And the thing about youth sports being universal is becoming a casualty of the budget wars and neoliberalism, particularly in our cities. And you see that in certain statistics like the dwindling number of African-American baseball players, because Major League – I mean, it's gone from roughly 25% of all players were African-American to now it's under 8%. And in that same time, Major League Baseball has invested billions of dollars in Venezuela and the Dominican Republic to develop talent very cheaply and in highly exploitative circumstances and conditions that no major league owner would ever allow their child to live in, if you look at how these academies work. So all of that together has produced a sports environment which does not feel like a level playing field, which to me is at the heart of what's so appealing to us about sports.
Do you see it changing or do you see it getting worse?
It's getting worse. Yeah. Oh, absolutely, it's getting worse. It's only going to get better when neoliberalism is pushed back. And that's the difficult thing about it, is that as long as neoliberalism and globalization hold sway, that will be a factor in how athletes are developed. As long as colleges cost $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, parents are going to feel this incredible pressure to have their kids on the scholarship pipeline, where they're from the age of six competing viciously and brutally against other kids in their neighborhood for the hope of actually getting that scholarship. And it's a very destructive environment, one of the results of which is that 70% of kids actually quit or leave youth sports by age 13. 70%. So think about what that means. I mean, we pay a social cost for that in a lot of different areas, not the least of which is health, youth diabetes, and things of that nature. And the idea that kids just can't play is very destructive.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Patrick. Let's go next to Jason in Salinas. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. Going back to what's been happening with the workers at the Giants Stadium and thinking about stadiums nationwide, question is, has there been any attempt by these workers to try to get the actual athletes, the actual professional athletes, as sympathizers for their cause?
The answer to that, first of all, it's a terrific question. There have definitely been efforts by the union to do that, and those efforts are ongoing. And that's all I can really say publicly about it, because there are obviously a ton of factors at play as far as like which players have been approached, and I don't think it's appropriate for me to put them on blast, if you will, as they're considering the situation and negotiating pissing off their boss with doing this kind of secondary support action. So I would just say keep your eyes wide open and see what happens. But I'll tell you this, the first responsibility for it is not on your favorite individual Giant. It's on the Major League Baseball Players Association stepping up and giving their players cover to say, hey, they're part of our union. The players are part of our union. And as a union, we support these workers. That's step one.
And again, if you're just tuning in, out of the 800 concession workers at Candlestick AT&T Park, 97% of them voted to go on strike. And last night, a number of the workers said, "Don't bring your own food. Don't buy food at the concession stand." They haven't had a raise in 3 years. They make, on average, $11,000 per season. You tried to get the MLB to comment, Dave, and they
still
haven't
trying.
Called you, they
oh,
haven't
just still trying.
Back.
It's ongoing.
Yeah,
I'll put it at that. I don't want to be too critical until I actually hear an answer from them, and I do expect to hear an answer from them. But I think, I think the MLB Players Association should be front and center. I have no doubt in my mind that the NFL Players Association would by now have already said something in solidarity, that they were terrific with the Hyatt workers. They still are, not having players stay at Hyatt hotels for the duration of that labor conflict. And I think sports unions should take an aggressive role in seeing themselves as part of the broader labor movement.
We're speaking with Dave Zirin, sports editor at The Nation. His new book is Game Over, and he'll be speaking tonight at Soul Space. He'll be joined by Mary Tillman, the author of The Football Player, The Late Football Player, Pat Tillman, Soul Space is at 1714 Telegraph Avenue in Oakland. It's right near BART. You can find information about this event at our website, yourcallradio.org, and it kicks off at 7 o'clock. And if you'd like to join us, we've got one line open, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're talking today about sports and journalism and the intersection with politics. Let's go to Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark.
Hi, and thanks for the great show.
Thank you.
I wonder if we could get some comments from Mr. Zirin about our family has lost connection with professional baseball. They no longer broadcast on broadcast. It's all cable, sport cable. So we have no relationship with professional baseball anymore. And also, in Berkeley, the recent buyout of the football coach, $5 million, his annual salary was $3 million, whereas all the other coaches in the UC system was roughly $150,000 at best. I wonder if you could comment on the Berkeley situation. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, first and foremost, we talked about this last night, but Major League Baseball teams now see cable television as one of their two primary revenue streams. The other one is public funding. Now, what's left out of that equation, of course, is the masses of fans and their ability to either enjoy games on free TV or their ability to be able to afford to go to the park. And those things are really becoming afterthoughts. And so I'm actually very concerned. As someone who thinks that sports does have positive value, which I do believe, I'm very concerned that we need to save sports from the owners of sports, that the owners are actually messing up the world of sports. So I wrote a book called Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. And so that's my analysis of the situation is they actually think that they're in the process of killing the golden goose. And soon every sport is going to be sort of like boxing, where only a very small number of people get to really see it on pay-per-view. And so a very small number of people enrich themselves greatly in the world of boxing, while the masses of people are sort of cut out of it. That's not a defense of boxing as a sport, which is a whole separate discussion, but it's more the economic model, which enriches the few, which I think I'm very fearful is what is part of what's going on with a lot of these big cable packages.
Well, and you said also that in the olden days, the fans actually used to matter, and now it's just they really don't.
And it's not because the owners were nicer, but it was before cable television. It was before this very neoliberal idea of corporate welfare and putting that kind of money into the public funding of stadiums. It's not something that would have occurred to people.
And this is why the games are longer, because of the
more
commercials.
Well, baseball in particular, but actually basketball as well. There are more commercials as well. Football, there are more commercials as well.
By almost an hour in some cases.
In baseball. But in all the sports, there's more commercialization, of course, because that's who's lining the owner's pockets. Now, one of the things that sometimes people ask me, like how can, given all that's wrong with sports, how can you be a sports fan? And if I'm being really honest, like if I've taken my sodium pentothal, I say that if I hadn't invested a couple $100 in a TiVo, I don't think I could be a sports fan, seriously, because I start watching an hour after it started and I fast forward through the commercials, because the commercials to me are maddening exercises in torture. I feel like the guy in Clockwork Orange with his eyes pulled open having to watch this horribleness. So it's that makes that makes a difference. Lucky to have one.
I want to read a couple emails. Anne says, I want to say thanks again to Dave for his articulate expressions of support for victims of rape and understanding of rape culture. He's gone far beyond simplistic finger wagging or hollow words of sympathy and blame to lead us to really understand the underlying issues. This is exactly what we need in order to address these horrors. Specifically, thanks for opening my eyes to the exploitation of the young male athletes by schools that make a profit off the unpaid labor of these men, and the culture in which women and young girls are really part of the plunder offered to the boys. I intuitively felt that these young men could not be vilified or cast aside as pariahs, but did not know the specifics of their reality.
Well, she just said it. I don't need to give any analysis based on that. But that is there is a political economy at play in how jock culture becomes rape culture. And it's frankly, it parallels very strongly some of the things that have been in the news recently about military culture and rape culture. A lot of the cases about sexual assault, that's been a lot of discussion in the media about sexual assault in the military. There are a lot of strong connections there. To me, the jock culture aspect of it is also very strongly related to the fact that a lot of these young people are paid in worship, basically. And they create these huge financial windfalls for the school and then become not only protected from things like crime or sexual assault, but it actually becomes encouraged and egged on inside the locker room and inside these communities. And it doesn't have to be that way. That's not something that's inherent in sports, but it is something that's inherent. I mean, it's a very difficult thing because people ask me, like, sometimes, what's rape culture? Like, what? How do you define that? And the answer I give is I say, well, rape culture is our culture when it goes unchallenged. Rape culture is American culture. Rape culture is 21st century culture. It's our media culture when it goes unchallenged. And so I don't think sports culture is inherently a rape culture, but I do think it becomes that when you don't have people standing up inside sports and saying certain kind of behaviors are wrong and sexism needs to be challenged and all the rest of it.
Well, thank you for the email, Ann. Such an important issue. Dave Zirin is sports editor at The Nation and author of Game Over. We've got a number of calls. Why don't we take a few and then we'll get a response from Dave. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. A couple of questions and maybe one, and I'm going to have to turn. I always have to do this, turn my radio down. Sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead.
One thing is I have a story regarding an Olympic coach that I'd like to broach to you, not on the air, but I'm wondering if there's a way to contact you, and then I want to ask a question about Lance Armstrong.
Oh, sure. Well, first ask the Lance Armstrong question. You can contact me through my website, edgeofsports.com.
Okay. Listening to you talk and knowing this subject pretty well because I was both an athlete and a coach, sports, and this is nothing new to you, sports is just a religion in this society. You don't have to go very far to see that. There's so much money involved in especially professional sports, but now getting down into college sports, much bigger than it ever was. The question I have is, knowing what I know about sports, and I've lost almost total interest in sports, even though I was completely involved in it as a player and a coach, I just wonder what kind of values, when I read my local sports rag, I'm just wondering what kind of values young people are growing up with, given all this, what I'd call corruption, if you will, and venality in sports, and especially when you look at somebody like Armstrong, who lied for years and then was found out and had to come clean, and you wonder what some high school or junior high school boy or girl is learning in terms of values when you look at this stuff.
Well, it's a great question. The issue of performance-enhancing drugs is a complicated and nuanced issue, particularly when you factor in issues like, to take Lance Armstrong's story himself, raised by a single mom who's a cashier in a small Texas town. And there is a certain kind of moralism that goes into saying this person should not take performance-enhancing drugs and become a multimillionaire and should be just content to get a job working at the cashier next to his mom. It's a little hard for me to stomach saying that when you have people like Larry Ellison and how he makes his billions of dollars and somehow we excuse those kinds of crimes. It reminds me of the famous quote that U.S. society is like a magical fishing net that catches the minnows while the whales go free. But at the same time, I have to say that the part of the Lance Armstrong story that to me is very disturbing, and make no mistake about it, you can go back and look at my stuff. Like, I went hammer and tongs on Lance Armstrong because the part of his story that I found there are several parts of his story that I found particularly disgusting, more disgusting than him using performance-enhancing drugs, quite frankly. And that's, first of all, the fact that he acted as a manager of this team of bikers, and there is clear evidence that he pressured other bikers to use performance-enhancing drugs. There's clear evidence that he threatened other bikers, and he also threatened, and he's admitted to this. No, this is nothing that you're going to get sued for, Rose. I probably, like, he threatened to have people sued and ruined. who tried to stand up for him because he had financial resources and they didn't. He was like the Tony Soprano of the cycling world, and he should be criticized for that. The second thing that he should be criticized for is that there's really no sport that needs a union more than cyclists. I mean, the death total, I mean, it's horrific what you have to go through. If you had the health figures in the NFL, which has been under criticism for health issues, particularly head injuries, that you had in cycling, though, there would be weekly congressional investigations. And Lance Armstrong was really the one person who could have supported unionizing efforts of cyclists and made a huge difference, chose not to, spoke openly about why he chose not to. And so you know what? It's like he had this individual ethos. He bullied other people. And so there's a lot of just desserts going on right now in terms of the fallout that he's experiencing.
Oh, I didn't know about the suing. I guess I didn't follow it that closely. Or, I mean, the threats to other bikers.
Oh, yeah. No, threats to other bikers, threats to the wives of other bikers, threats to, I mean, and he admitted to most of this in his interview with Oprah Winfrey. And the worst part about it, there was one very awkward moment where, you know, he's talking to Oprah and it's like, and this woman said, he said, listen, you, it was like the Roper read this quote and he said, listen, you fat cow, I'm going to sue you till you don't have another cent left and you're going to be ruined. And Oprah said, what do you say about that? And he said, and he tried to make a joke and he said, well, I never called her fat.
Ooh.
And, you know, jeez. Oprah's like, that was the one time you saw Oprah look like she was getting mad. Like, don't make fat jokes to me. I've had my own issues. So there's a lot about him that's not only charmless, but deeply, deeply unethical. And, you know, I got to say, like, there's a part of me that shares your disdain or your concern, I should say, about the absence of role models. But there's also a part of me that knows that sports has always been corrupt and none of these guys were ever these great role models. Some certainly were, like Jackie Robinson certainly was, both in terms of his personal life and his playing career. But there are also some players now you could look at in that way as well, who are tremendous role models. My dear friend Scott Fujita, who just retired from the NFL, he should be a role model for anybody out there who wants role models for their kids. And it's... And one of the things he got from being such a role model was he was accused by the NFL of being part of a bounty scheme on other players to hurt other players that was later found to have no basis to it. And I always thought it was fascinating that here's Scott Fujita, who devoted his NFL career to things like health concerns and LGBT rights. Mm. And it's like he was the one who was targeted by the National Football League.
We have an email from Sylvia in Albany who says, are the wages and benefits for concession workers better for the workers who work for Green Bay Packers because they're owned by the public? And she's a retired school teacher, support the union. What are good ways we can support the Giants workers?
Great question all around. No, they're not paid more at Lambeau Field because it's fan-owned. But one of the differences that needs to be said is that the standard of living in Green Bay, Wisconsin is much less expensive, to put it mildly, than the standard of living here in the Bay. So it's like even when people compare wages and say that the workers at AT&T Park are the highest paid in the country, it's just like, how can you say that decontextualized with what it means? I mean, we were at last night, we had people come up and ask us questions and they would start by saying, hi, I was just kicked out of my house.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just sort of like people say it so matter-of-factly.
Yeah.
And Rose, you said to me in the green room before last night, you said it's never been worse in terms of the gentrification and the housing stuff than it is now in 2013. And I asked other people that very question afterwards because I was like, I can't believe that given all the stories from the 90s and the previous tech bubbles. And everybody to a person said, no, Rose is absolutely right. It's never been this bad. And that's stunning to me, given that there is such a history starting in the late 70s of gentrification and being people forced out. But what people can do to support the team is there's a lot people can do. They have a website. I think it's the Giant Zero.
Right, thegiantzero.org, and it's yeah. Z-E-R-O. Yeah,
thegiantzero.org. Go there, and that's where you can find some tools to find out how to support the workers. I do hope the union adopts an aggressive solidarity plan for people. Like, this is the day you can come to the park and picket. This is the day that you can blast fax or blast call or blast email management. I hope they come up with a plan for that, because I think in this town, it would get mammoth support. And frankly, it would get support around the country.
And they're having a meeting on Saturday about this. And also, Dave, last night you mentioned a story you read, and BuzzFeed has written about this, that a hedge fund manager rented out AT&T Park for a couple hours a few days ago for $500,000.
While they were organizing.
Yes.
I mean while they were negotiating.
For about 100 friends who could kind of bat around a couple balls, drink a few beers on the...
I got to ask you, because I didn't know that BuzzFeed wrote about it. Did they write about it in the context of the union workers?
They did, actually. I'm actually looking for the article. Yeah, it's the headline, Millionaire Hedge Fund Manager Rents Out AT&T Park as Concession Workers Near Strike Over Low Wages.
Wow.
Yeah, Mike Wilkins.
That says it all. I mean, my God, sometimes it's like that. That's the other thing about sports, is that sometimes it creates these narratives that if a fiction writer put them to paper, they would be seen as too outrageous.
And we've got just about a minute left, Dave. I mean, there's so much, you know, you've got so much to choose from.
Yeah, we could do another hour.
And you've got such a niche. How do you decide where to put your focus and what's important?
Well, that's a good reason why I want other people to be political sports writers. And you actually asked me for some good journalism that I saw this week. And
yeah.
In that vein, I will take my last minute to say that. There's a great young writer. Her name is Jessica Luther. She writes for a lot of places, but in The Atlantic, she has a tremendous piece about Jimmy Connors, who just wrote his memoirs, where he somehow felt it was okay to call out Chris Evert for having an abortion when they are in a relationship. And it's disgusting. And Jessica Luther wrote this really, really good piece about what makes Jimmy Connors such an oinking pig for doing that. And it's like, that's the kind of writing that we need. That's the kind of sports writing that we need. Not just the kind of like, oh, Jimmy Connors wrote this, or even worse, the shaming of Chris Evert, but the kind of writing that actually looks critically at what some of these people on this hyper-exalted brought to you by Nike platform do.
Well, we'll definitely have to have her on. Dave Zirin is sports editor at The Nation magazine. He hosts Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM, and he's author of Game Over, How Politics Has Turned the Sports World Upside Down. Dave, thank you so much.
See you at Soul Space tonight.
Yes, Soul Space tonight in Oakland. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Matt Martin, joining Rose and Dave here in the studio to ask for your support before we go to our bonus hour of Your Call with Robert McChesney. But right now we have a challenge, and it's the challenge to grow the kind of radio, the kind of local media that we need. Dave Zirin, this is the kind of voice you get to hear on Your Call day in and day out, and we get to hear your calls. But we only have this resource if all of us come together and give our support. Be the next person to call or click 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917, or a click is as good as a call at kalw.org.
800-525-9917. Dave, I was telling you about our Shorter is Better campaign. We're getting such a great response. We're not breaking into any content. kalw.org, 800-525-9917.
So Dave, we don't have much time, but lay it on the line for people.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's a reason why community-supported radio is also the best radio, because it actually speaks to the needs of the community. We're telling your stories, and that doesn't happen through corporate media. It only happens through community-supported radio. So I really want to encourage people to support it. It's the only way we're going to develop a new generation of voices in this country.
KALW.org, 800-525-9917. We have Dave's book, Game Over, yours for a $120 contribution. But the most important thing is not the level you give. We've had pledges of $10 and $1,000 today. It's each person bringing what they can so we keep non-corporate, non-commercial media on the air at 91.7 FM. 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. We believe Shorter is Better, and we know you do too. Thank you for all of your support. Keep us independent and strong. KALW.org.
We came into this break needing 20 calls or clicks to make it to our challenge, which gives us an additional $1,000. Be the next person to help us make it there, Rose. We don't want to miss this. We want to keep this station strong and keep these membership drives as short as possible. 800-525-9917 or kalw.org. Dave, when you were talking about the political economy involved in the jock culture and the rape culture, I thought, where else do we get to hear that kind of conversation? We need this space, and we need to grow it. Your support makes it possible. 800-525-9917, KALW.org. Keep these critical dialogues about things that matter, things in our real lives that do make a difference. That's what we make happen here at Your Call and KALW. Your support makes it happen.
800-525-9917. We're not cutting into programming. We've got just about 10 seconds left. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
You're listening to KALW in San Francisco, where we keep it short with your support. 800-525-9917. Online at KALW.org. Rose, we are very close to making this listener challenge. Let's do it. Another $1,000 for local powered radio. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
This is KALW San Francisco.